Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The 2015 Florida lawmaking session is now underway as Governor Rick Scott touts the state's exceptionalism.
I'm looking forward to working side by side with you during the session to achieve our shared goals, inspire future generations to dream, and keep Florida working.
Also tonight, supporters of a Medicaid expansion in Florida got a major boost on the first day of session. The Senate will take up the issue starting tomorrow.
It's very encouraging, and we're very optimistic. We have put together a framework and now a bill that we believe is very fiscally responsible.
We'll also look at possible legislation impacting gambling, the date of Florida's presidential primary election, prison reform, and much, much more. I'm Tom Flanagan, and on this, the 170th anniversary of Florida statehood, this is Capitol Report. By long-standing tradition, the start of the yearly Florida legislative session includes the governor's State of the State address. This was Governor Rick Scott's fifth State of the State speech. He kicked it off somewhat uncharacteristically by poking a bit of fun at himself.
So now it's time to start another State of the State speech, or as I would like to call it, a chance to show off my world-renowned oratorical skills.
If that modest self-deprecation was unexpected, most of the rest of Governor Scott's talk was more typical, a litany of the state's economic strengths.
Enterprise Florida has won over 400 competitive projects. Companies like Hertz, Navy Federal Credit Union. We are a right-to-work state. We are the gateway to Latin America. We are the number two state in the country for trade infrastructure. Number two for aerospace and aviation establishments. We're the second best state for business by CEO Magazine, and we'll absolutely soon be number one.
Not to mention the state's annual tourism numbers now flirting with the 100 million mark. Governor Scott had a prime prescription for Florida's staying the economic growth course.
In order to be a land where dreams come true, I believe we have to absolutely outcompete the world. There are five ways we can do it. First, let's keep cutting taxes.
That probably drew the biggest audience applause of the speech. Many of the governor's proposed tax cuts target business, but he's proposing one that would impact just about everyone.
I have recommended cutting the tax on cell phones and TVs for every Florida family, so they can save around $43 a year for spending as little as $100 a month on his cell phones and TV bills combined.
Besides the little self-jab at the outset, there was another unusual aspect to Governor Scott's speech. In the past, few could accuse him of being overly cozy with lawmakers, but this week the governor invited a record number of them to the mansion. And in his State of the State, he promised to keep working at that good working relationship.
Members of the Senate, members of the House, I commit to all of you that I will be a tireless partner in your fight to make Florida the best place in the world for all of our children and all of our grandchildren to get a great job and live their dreams.
Of course, there's always a counterpoint, and in the case of a Republican governor like Scott, that opposition comes from the Democrats. In her response, Senate Minority Leader Arthenia Joyner of Tampa took aim at Scott's claims that Florida's economic surge is impacting just about everyone.
Just ask Adhani Jidani, a 30-year-old single mom in Tampa, who works two minimum wage jobs at fast food restaurants. Sadly, the road to today's State of the State came at your expense.
And for House Minority Leader Mark Pafford of West Palm Beach, the looming loss of federal low-income pool funding for hospitals is a big problem.
Even though the federal government has said it's going to stop spending $1 billion in Florida, Governor Scott included that money in his own budget. It could leave a billion-dollar hole.
Still, the fun has just begun as the 60-day session is off and running. The Florida Senate is preparing to start debate over expanding Medicaid in Florida. Len Hatter reports the issue has been a major contention point between the House and Senate for the past 3 years.
At stake is more than $50 billion in federal funding to cover nearly a million low-income uninsured Floridians. The issue? The Senate has long supported expanding Medicaid. The House has not. House Speaker Steve Crisafulia said his chamber's position remains unchanged, but he's also left a crack in the door for possible talks.
Last year we did nothing on the issue. It's becoming another issue, you know, another year that we're talking about it early on, but we've come a long way with the flexibility that's been provided from Washington. But ultimately, for me, putting people into a broken system is not the answer. I think fixing the system is the answer.
Now there are new factors in the conversation, like the fact Florida could lose $1 billion in federal money that reimburses hospitals for treating uninsured patients. The low-income pool expires this summer. And during a visit to Florida in January, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell made her preference clear.
The pool money was money that was about helping low-income people have access, and that's what the pool money is about. I think we believe that an important way to extend that coverage for those low-income individuals, as was passed in the Affordable Care Act, is this issue of Medicaid expansion.
The loss of the federal funding, which could be closer to $2 billion once state matching funds are added, is more than offset if Florida chooses to use federal Medicaid expansion funding to cover people in the so-called coverage gap. About 800,000 Floridians, mainly adults, make too much money to qualify for the state's current Medicaid program and too little money to get a federal subsidy to purchase insurance on the federal government's exchanges. And Tuesday, Senate President Andy Gardner, a hospital executive, said his chamber will discuss expanding Medicaid.
We want to talk about it. I don't know how it ends. I haven't read the last chapter on this one. But we, at least in the Senate, will have the discussion if that's the best way to go for Florida.
During the past year, groups that previously opposed expanding Medicaid, like the Florida Chamber of Commerce and the Physicians Lobby, the Florida Medical Association, have come to publicly back it. The conversation has increased largely because this year businesses can be fined for not providing health insurance to their employees. And many of the Medicaid gap population are employed. Also driving the conversation has been a coalition of local businesses and healthcare providers who created a path toward expansion called A Healthy Florida Works.
Very encouraging news coming out of the Senate today, yes.
Jennifer Fennell is a spokeswoman for the coalition. The group has put its plan in a bill form and is now shopping around for a sponsor. Under A Healthy Florida Works, an outside vendor would be hired to run an exchange-like program. Florida would pull down $50 billion in federal funds to pay for the Medicaid expansion. Those who use it would pay premiums based on their income, and they'd have to be employed or looking for work or advancing their education. There's also a lockout period for people who don't pay their premiums. And Fennell says the group is ready to present its plan.
We believe it's very fiscally responsible. It's based on free market principles, and we think it's a really great opportunity for the legislature to look at a different way to approach health care coverage extension.
Jacksonville Senator Aaron Bean will start work on the Senate's Medicaid expansion proposal and the Florida Healthy Works plan Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a bill that seeks to reset Florida's presidential primary date from January back to March zipped through a committee with unanimous support.
You are recognized to explain PCB RC EC 1505.
Prison reform will be on the minds of lawmakers this week, and hearing from the correctional officers is the goal of at least one Senate panel.
I've got some folks that would really like to talk, but they're afraid of retaliation.
As lawmakers prepare to answer a number of gaming questions this session, one lawmaker is offering another option, more than 300 pages of it.
The best decision-making comes with knowledge. When members have information, we are empowered to make good public policy for Florida.
And a measure giving cash incentives to state workers who adopt is working its way through the legislature.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
As Florida lawmakers continue to delve into making changes to the state's troubled prison system, some want to hear from the employees affected by the changes. But as Sasha Cordner reports, several correctional officers say they're afraid of retaliation from the prison agency due to a new policy some are calling a gag order.
A day before the Florida legislative session officially began, the Senate Criminal Justice Committee's agenda included testimony from some Florida Department of Corrections employees on Florida's troubled prison system. It's been plagued by inmate deaths, allegations of abuse by prison guards, and cover-ups. Through several hearings, issues with understaffing, equipment, and officer shifts have come up as well. But the panel's chairman, Baker Republican Greg Evers, says the DOC employees were afraid to appear.
We haven't really discussed on the gag order, quote, that was sent out, this kind of stuff. But I've got some folks that would really like to talk, but they're afraid of retaliation.
Evers says he got at least 12 people who were willing to testify and even come to the panel via subpoena. But he adds a new department policy that could mean they lose their jobs is a deterrent.
Had one fellow to tell me that you subpoena me, you put me under oath, I'm going to tell you. But I got two girls in college, and I'm afraid that I can't support those two girls in college if I do that. Now, they all stepped up and said, absolutely. Here's what's going on. Here's what's happening. But this is what will happen, because then I will be looked at as if I'm snitching on somebody.
The so-called gag order was a policy implemented by newly appointed DOC Secretary Julie Jones called a confidentiality agreement. In it, she forbid inspectors from discussing information about investigations to anyone outside those who need to know. Anyone found to be in violation would be fired. It's even the subject of a lawsuit. All that had come around a time in early February when Evers, along with other lawmakers, had asked for information on investigations pertaining to whistleblower claims. So during a House Judiciary Committee hearing weeks ago, Jones explained her decision was necessary to protect investigators.
Even in situations that are unfounded, you don't want gossip, you don't want water cooler talk, you don't want anyone talking, I investigated so-and-so, you know, guess what they were accused of doing. It's not professional.
Still, she admits,
quite frankly, when that confidentiality agreement came out, the timing was terrible. I've just decided it's best to just rip the Band-Aid off and go forward. It was not intended as a gag order. It does not keep those investigators from collaborating on information. It has absolutely no overriding factor on public records requests. And lastly, the authority of this body or the Senate or anyone else that has the authority over this agency can continue to do their business, and in no way does that eliminate your ability to talk to anyone or ask questions.
And she reiterated much of those same thoughts to Senator Evers during Monday's hearing, so we asked her to make him a promise.
Would you go on the record and tell folks that they will not receive any retaliation if they come before this committee and talk?
Her reply?
Senator, not only can I do that and assure that anyone that wants to talk to this committee that they have free passage, I can also tell you that we have now, at end of business today, had staff meeting with at least 100 plus people at 27 of our institutions where they have stood up and said, the uniforms suck. We're understaffed. Mm-hmm. Everything that you just mentioned, and no one has been fired.
Meanwhile, an aide to Senator Evers says Jones' message is expected to be relayed to those employees who want to come forward, and they should expect to appear at the Senate Criminal Justice Committee's meeting next week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Odds are good for a gaming shakeup this session. The first bill is passed out of the Senate. It's a measure relating to greyhound racing. Meanwhile, Regan McCarthy reports lawmakers are considering a massive gaming overhaul bill in the House.
A portion of the state's gaming agreement with the Seminole Indians, granting them exclusive rights to card games like blackjack, is set to expire. And House Majority Leader Dana Young says she wants to make sure lawmakers have alternatives to consider while deciding whether to renew that part of the compact.
It is incumbent on us to challenge or at least examine the status quo and determine whether the current course is in the best interest of Florida. The best decision-making comes with knowledge.
Young says it doesn't make sense for lawmakers to discuss gaming issue by issue. She's sponsoring a 300-page bill that she says looks at all the angles and all the issues. One major move the measure makes is to pave the way for two destination resort casinos in Broward and Miami-Dade counties. Young says that combines with what she calls an unprecedented contraction of gaming by requiring the incoming resorts to buy up other small existing casinos. But while lawmakers are signaling they're willing to let the Seminole Compact expire, the tribe is fighting back through an ad touting the revenue Florida gets each year from the agreement.
Nearly 5 years ago, the state and the Seminole Tribe of Florida approved an historic compact.
To make sure that gaming was controlled, profitable, and safe for more than 19 million Floridians.
Meanwhile, in the Senate, lawmakers approved the first bill to pass the full chamber this session. It would increase transparency and require better reporting of the injuries greyhounds sustain while racing.
We have a very special guest, and it's always nice to see her up in the gallery. Mrs. Gates is with us today. Mrs. Gates, it's good to see you.
The measure is named after Victoria Gates, the wife of former Senate President Don Gates. It passed the Senate unanimously, with 38 members signing on as co-sponsors. Representative Young's bill, back in the House, takes the idea a step further. It would decouple greyhound racing, meaning paramutual facilities would no longer be required to hold a certain number of races in order to continue their other gaming activities. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
After plans to submit Florida's presidential primary vote didn't go as planned, the legislature wants to set its primaries back to where they were. Matthew Seeger reports that a ratified bill will reverse the 2016 presidential primaries from January back to March.
Florida's reputation as an influential swing state in elections hasn't gone unnoticed. At one point, state lawmakers were fed up with being recognized after states like Iowa and New Hampshire during the presidential primaries. There was also the fact that those states had a much less diverse voter pool to wade through, as USF political scientist Susan McManus explains.
Both parties felt like the process was nominating people that then would have more difficulty in maneuvering and successfully winning office by having to go through large urban states, which had a much different kind of politics.
So in the 2008 and 2012 elections, Florida had early primaries in January. This turned out to be a bad idea and didn't go over well with the national parties, especially the GOP. It wanted Florida to adhere to a set deadline of March. Florida's Republican Party had many of its delegates reduced as a penalty. Since the Democratic Party distributes its delegates equally amongst candidates, the Republican Party took the blow much harder. Again, McManus.
So there's a lot of interest in adhering more to the party rules this time out, which would allow the Republican Party of Florida to make a decision to give whomever wins all of the delegates instead of proportional allocation.
So in order to get their delegates back and comply with the GOP at all, Ron Lebaski, the general counsel for the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections, says that following the 2012 election, Florida's legislature moved the primary deadline back to where it was.
So March 1st was placed into the statute as being the appropriate date to consider having the presidential preference primary. At this point, the decision has been reached in the legislature to move that back from the March 1st date to March 15th, I think, again, to more consistently fall within the party rules.
And Monday, the bill to change the date to the 15th of March was passed so quickly that it left rubber on the linoleum.
And by your vote, PCB RCEC 1505 will be reported favorably.
No deliberation, no discussion or objection, and it passed unanimously. The same bill was brought to the attention of the Ethics Committee Tuesday afternoon. State Senator John Legge treated the committee to a pun referencing the Ides of March, with some debate from Chris Smith on the pronunciation of Ides.
I just want to question the wisdom of having the primary on the Ides of March.
The Ides of March?
Right? Ides of March, Ides?
Mr. Chair? It's actually the Ides of March.
Mispronunciations aside, the proposal zipped through and is once again on the fast track through the legislature. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Matthew Seeger.
after beer retailers and distributors challenged a legal exception that helps craft brewers open up tap rooms. Two Florida senators put forward a measure doing away with the exception completely, in effect ensuring breweries can sell beer on site. But Nick Evans reports the original challenge hasn't disappeared.
What is a structure? And how do you determine whether or not it promotes Florida tourism? And what on earth does this have to do with anything? That, of course, is a late 80s TV spot for Busch Gardens in Tampa. The theme park is at the center of a dispute about licensing for beer sales in the state. Florida has a three-tier alcohol distribution system based on the idea of separating businesses involved in brewing, distributing, and retailing. But you know what they say about rules and exceptions, right? Well, this one's no different.
It was enacted in 84, and truthfully, the genesis of the statute that we're looking at that is an exception was created in 1963. And what it said was a manufacturer is allowed – nothing will prevent a manufacturer from obtaining a vendor's license.
Josh Abishan is an attorney with the Florida Brewers Guild, and he's talking about what's known as the Busch Gardens or tourism exception. It allows brewers to step into the retail tier by getting a vendor's license so they can sell beer where they make it. Prior to Anheuser-Busch's lobbying effort, brewers were limited to three vendor's licenses. When lawmakers made the change in 1984, they removed limits on the amount of licenses and added language requiring structures that promote the brewery and the tourism industry of the state. And that's the exception. You can get a vendor's license if your brewery promotes tourism. But that brings us back to the original question. What's a structure that promotes tourism? Early this year, the Florida Retail Federation launched the administrative challenge that's brought everyone into this small hearings chamber at the Department of Business and Professional Regulations. At the front of the room is a curved table, and four agency officials are alternatively listening attentively and scribbling notes. There's a court reporter tapping away to one side and fake plants in the corners. The Retail Federation alleged the department was too readily awarding licenses under the tourism exception. Two beer distributor groups joined the case, but administrative law is a bit unique. The court doesn't send people to jail or award damages. It considers whether state departments are doing their job correctly. So the case claims it's unclear how the agency determines if a brewer promotes tourism. And because of that, it should have to initiate rulemaking to clarify its procedures. The department could have taken the matter before a judge, but instead it agreed and set up this rule development meeting. But there is a certain sense of futility.
This proposed committee substitute will add a couple of other features to the bill. It deletes the tourist and structures language from the vendor license brewer exemption that's currently in
force. That's Jack Latvala, a Republican senator from Clearwater who's been one of the most vociferous lawmakers in recent years when it comes to beer regulations. In particular, he's been trying to do away with Florida's growler restrictions for 3 years now. But the bill he's pushing this session also takes aim at the tourism exception, and it would leave the rulemaking process moot. Latvala says his bill is directly related to the Retail Federation's administrative challenge.
This addresses the issues raised recently by the lawsuit that was filed by some of the folks in the industry seeking clarification. And this amendment will give clarification to that issue.
But Donna Blanton, an attorney representing the Florida Beer Wholesalers Association, says a bill isn't a law, and until the governor signs on the dotted line, the rulemaking should proceed.
But we never know what's going to happen in the legislative process, and the longer I'm around that process, the more I've learned not to predict what may or may not happen. And if, in fact, they pass something, then the division will be dealing with a different statute. But as Mr. Martinez said at the beginning of the workshop today, we are here working under the statute we have now. And unless and until that changes, that's what we have to deal with.
Department officials didn't come to the workshop with draft proposals in hand, and it's unlikely they'll host many more workshops while the legislature is in session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Ronald J. Evans takes a look at what's coming up at the Capitol tomorrow.
Lawmakers will be taking up several major issues tomorrow, including prison reform. The Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will discuss a bill by Senator Greg Evers that's aimed at improving prison safety and ensuring that corrections officers don't mistreat inmates. The bill prompted in part by several unexplained deaths of Florida inmates. Before the Senate Education Appropriations Subcommittee are a series of proposals largely directed at improving the educational opportunities for people with disabilities. A health care for immigrant children bill is before the Senate Health and Human Services Appropriations Committee. The bill seeks to help lawfully residing immigrant children get health care through the KidCare subsidized insurance program. The legislature will consider a series of gun measures this session before the Senate Community Affairs Committee tomorrow. Consideration of a bill by Senator Jeff Brandes that would allow gun owners to carry their weapons into emergency shelters during a storm. The first of several bills involving student testing will be considered by the Senate Education Pre-K Committee. The measure by committee chair John Legge calls for changes in the state's new standardized testing system, including limiting the amount of time students spend on state and local tests. The state cabinet also meets tomorrow at 9. Those are some of the bills on tomorrow's legislative agenda. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, state workers could get between $5,000 and $10,000 for adopting children under a bill passed by a House panel today. As Jim Ash reports, lawmakers also want better scorecards for adoption providers.
When Ari Saylor saw 3-year-old Betty, she didn't see a child with Down syndrome and other challenges. She saw an irresistible baby who needed an adoptive home. Saylor opened hers.
My belief is that there is a family for every child out there.
30 years later, Saylor is executive director of One Church, One Child of Tallahassee, which steers potentially adoptive parents to the right agencies. Saylor welcomes any move to promote adoption.
My belief is that there is a family for every child out there.
House Health and Human Services Chair Jason Broder of Sanford wants to do just that. His bill would give state workers a $5,000 incentive for adopting children caught in the foster care system and $10,000 for those with special needs. Here's Broder before a House committee.
In 2014, we had 670 children who were available for adoption, but did not have an adoptive family identified for them, despite actively seeking one.
His bill passed unanimously, but not without some turbulence. Democrat David Richardson of Miami Beach tried unsuccessfully to use a parliamentary procedure to block an amendment allowing foster and adoptive parents to homeschool their children. In the adoption arena, special needs children include those older than 8, minorities, those who come with a brother or sister, or who have emotional or developmental disabilities. A companion measure by former Senate President Don Gates of Niceville will go a step further than the House version. It carves $3.4 million out of the General Revenue Fund to pay for the incentives. Gates told a Social Services Committee last month it could be a money saver.
Right now it costs about $35,000 a year to keep a child in a group home. It costs over $6,000 a year to keep a child in foster care with a foster care family.
His bill also would give the Department of Children and Families $6.5 million in extra money once it comes up with ways for measuring the program's performance. Last summer, 3,031 Florida children were available for adoption, Senate experts say. In 2013, 93% of children adopted from the welfare system in Florida had special needs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Matthew Seeger, and Ronald J. Eben. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2015 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.